This is Max Flight. I love aviation podcasts. That's why I do Airplane Geeks, the UAV Digest, and the PAXX podcast. But when I need a break from creating my own shows, I turn to Extended, a great aerospace program.
This is XTP Media.
In such a dark time, space exploration, the stories of the people behind it, and the possibility and the wonder can give us hope. It doesn't matter whether you're 6 or 66, there's still hope and wonder and meaning to come from space and to know more about why we explore space, how it benefits our life, and what could potentially be out there.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Welcome to the latest episode of Extended, the ETOPS Aviation Podcast. And we're ready for takeoff.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 111 of aerospace radio station Extended. Today, I'm joined by Ellie Carter, and Ellie is a private pilot and STEM ambassador. Ellie, how are you today?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm really good. Really excited about this episode. And we also have Tim Robinson. Tim, of course, is the editor-in-chief of Aerospace Magazine. Tim, how are you?
Yeah, not too bad, thanks. Hello, everybody.
And we have a guest, a very special guest, Sarah Crudders today. Sarah's a space journalist, international TV host, and award-winning author. She's got an academic background in astrophysics and is a global thought leader in the growing commercial space sector. Sarah, welcome to Extended.
What an introduction. Thank you for that. I'm so excited to be on this podcast to talk, you know, I guess the stuff that I love goes a little bit higher than aeroplanes, but I'm so excited to be here, and thank you so much for having me. And it's an exciting month for space exploration as well, so I'm looking forward to discussing that with you.
Yeah, well, we're going to come back to talk a little bit about your book a bit later, Looking Up, of course, your latest book, I want to say.
It's called Look Up.
Look Up. Oh, there you go.
That's outtake number one.
So, do people listen to the outtakes first? My book is called Look Up, Our Story with the Stars.
Right, but let's first have a little look at what's caught our eye in the news. And as we record today, it's the 10th of February. We've seen the Hope orbiter arrive here at Mars, but we've still got Tianwen-1 and, of course, NASA's Perseverance to arrive on the 18th of February. Sarah, can I come to you first? How exciting is these couple of weeks for space exploration?
Well, it's a huge leap forward, I guess is the right expression, for space exploration. So obviously Hope arrived yesterday. What's the day today? So Hope arrived on the 9th. Tianwen-1 arrived today, which is obviously the 10th of February. So it's arrived in orbit. It's going to, in a couple of months' time, attempt to actually land a yet-to-be-named lander and robot on the surface of Mars. And then, of course, you've got Perseverance, which is basically like NASA's Curiosity rover, but on steroids. So it's the next generation of really souped up, full of technology, Mars rover, which NASA's going to use to hunt for microbial signs of life on Mars. So really game-changing stuff. And I think what's so exciting about this month and these space missions is that Mars is such an elusive place. I mean, throughout, you know, human history, people have looked up at Mars. It was named, you know, after gods of war during Roman times, and now, you know, 100 years ago, people thought there might have been life on Mars. There was confusion about canals on Mars, and of course, there wasn't life like human life. But now what we're seeing is space exploration has gone from the preserve of two superpowers. Of course, the Americans were first to really successfully get to the surface of Mars, and the preserve of two superpowers trying to battle out to explore space. And now we're seeing different nations, so lots of different countries across the world exploring space. And the fact that in the space of a matter of weeks, we've got three nations arriving. We've got the UAE, China, and the USA. That's just incredibly exciting, because the more countries that are exploring space, the more opportunity for science and discovery, as well as hopefully in the future, international collaboration. So it's a huge leap forward in terms of capabilities. And ultimately, these missions piece together a really important jigsaw puzzle. And that jigsaw puzzle is, you know, where did we come from? Why do we exist? Are we alone in the universe? And by doing science, studying other worlds, we can try and answer those questions. So it's a hugely exciting time, and it's going to be hugely exciting to see all the data that comes back and how that transforms our understanding, not only of this barren, lifeless, or seemingly lifeless world, but also life here on Earth.
To hear and learn a little bit more about the individual missions themselves, I mean, it's fantastic news that the United Arab Emirates have got that probe into Mars's orbit. What's that probe particularly focused on looking for?
So the HOPE probe, which is the UAE's orbiter around Mars, it's going to be looking at the weather on Mars. So it's the first time we've really had a study like that. And it's also a hugely prestigious mission, just for the pride of the UAE, to show that they too can do this great thing. And they see it as an economic benefit as well as a scientific one. So they want to encourage uptake in science subjects and the benefits that can bring economically, but you know, by inspiring the nation of what they can achieve. So it is kind of twofold. You've got this scientific thing, we're going to be studying, you know, looking at the weather on the atmosphere of Mars, but secondly, and just as importantly, they're using it to inspire their country and to inspire a nation about what they can achieve in the future and the value of STEM subjects.
And how much do we know about what the Chinese orbiter is going to do? Is it carrying in within the orbiter something to land on the surface? Is it already there?
Well, as I said, yes, the Tianwen-1 is carrying yet to be named lander and rover, and basically it'll land on the surface of Mars in the same way that Chinese missions, so Chang'e 4, Chang'e 5, actually landed on the surface of the moon. So you use the lander as a platform, and then the rover crawls off that and starts exploring. So Tianwen-1 went into successful orbit around Mars today, and China, as you may be aware, is notoriously secretive in terms of what they let the public know about space exploration and the projects that they're doing. So we don't know too much about the exact landing date, but in the next few months, some have said May, some have said April, that's when China is going to attempt to successfully land on the surface. And if that landing is successful, China will become the first, the second nation ever, second only to the United States, to successfully land on the surface of Mars. But of course, there's a lot of ifs and buts. It's very complicated landing on the surface of Mars. But again, as with the UAE, this is a huge leap forward in terms of national prestige and national pride for China. You've got to remember, when humans were walking on the moon, many people in China were languishing under Mao and probably weren't even aware that humans were walking on the moon. So to now, as a Chinese citizen, for example, be able to look up and know that there's a Chinese rover, or potentially, or could be a Chinese rover on the surface of Mars soon, that's very exciting for national pride.
Yeah. And to be honest, the creme de la creme as well is sitting out there in Perseverance. I mean, we all saw the last lander, the exciting breakthrough and landing, you know, the whole drama of that episode. How are you looking forward to Perseverance? Is it exciting? Are you nervous? How confident are we that it'll be okay?
Oh, that's a terrible question. You can't ask.
I know, it's just, I'm just really nervous.
Well, of course I'm excited. Aren't you guys excited? This is, you know, this is a next step. This is just, you know, robots are our eyes and ears in the universe, and until humans can go there. And so I grew up in the 90s. So as a child of the 90s, I really thought by this year, year 2021 now, that humans would be on the surface of Mars. And we haven't really got the space future we expected. but we have got these robots who are doing, which are doing incredible things. So Perseverance looks exactly like the Curiosity rover, which is already on Mars. But as I said, it's got all this extra technology on it. And obviously, you know, it's a more modern rover, and it's hugely exciting, but it is also terrifying because it's hard to land on Mars. Many missions have failed. I think at one point in history, it was 50% of missions failed trying to land on the surface of Mars. And that is because Mars has got a thin atmosphere. So it's got kind of like a disadvantage, whereas the moon's got next to no atmosphere, you know, no atmosphere for all intents and purposes. So you can just use retro rockets to land on the surface, and the Earth has a much thicker atmosphere. So you can use a parachute and heat shields to slow yourself down. On Mars, you kind of have the worst of both worlds when you're trying to land. So you need a gigantic parachute, or you need other different things. So they're going to be basically, I don't know if you remember, with the Curiosity landing using the sky crane, something pretty much the same is going to be used for the Perseverance rover. So it's a complex thing to land on the surface of Mars, to land something of that size on the surface of Mars. But fingers crossed it is successful, because then there's potentially going to be some huge science. And this Perseverance mission is hopefully part of a larger mission, which will eventually see a sample of Mars brought back to Earth for studying. And I think when we talk about, you know, profound questions such as, are we alone in the universe? The reality is, you know, as Carl Sagan said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And we haven't got that evidence yet, but it's likely that that clinching piece of evidence will realistically be in a lab on Earth, instead of someone wandering around the solar system, eventually on Mars, and picking up a rock and saying we found life. So that's very exciting, but it's, you know, a lot of things can go wrong, but we've got to remember this is the best of the best, and yeah, everything crossed for Perseverance. And of course, the Ingenuity helicopter as well.
First
aeronautical flight on another planet. That's pretty
cool. Yeah. Are you going to make it an honorary member of the Royal Aeronautical Society?
There you go, Tim. Put you on the spot.
It's a bit of a long way to go and present its fresh certificate, but we'll see what I can do.
Maybe Elon can give you a lift. Like.
Yeah. And Sarah, I've lost count of the trips back and forth to the States that you've made. Did you get to see Perseverance before it was packed up? On any of those trips?
I did not. You know, I've never actually been to JPL. So pre-COVID, anyone remember that?
BC, part? We call it, before COVID.
Before the world changed. Before, you know, when I used to wear clothes and not sweatpants. So I was working in the US and living in the UK, which is just a nightmare, but it meant I had great air miles and I loved flying. But no, I never got a chance to see Perseverance. I've never actually been to the Mars Yard at JPL. It's one of the few places I haven't visited at NASA, but so in answer to your question, I'm sorry to disappoint, but no, I haven't seen it up close.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for that, Sarah. Let's move on to a few other bits of news. Ellie, some bad news about the Yeovilton International Air Day. I know you've flown in and around the area. How disappointing is that?
It's such a shame. I know from my experience that some of the first inspiration that I had was from an air show. I remember when I was 8 or so, with a Belgium F-16 pilot who was on his knees telling me that I could become a pilot, and then going through the clock method for working out drift with a Royal Navy pilot. And then I got to fly in and kind of do that myself and encourage other people. And it was amazing. So it's really such a shame that people are going to miss out on that this year. It's such an important thing.
And did I not see that you did some of your aerobatic training from Yeovilton? Did I see something on that?
So it wasn't essentially training, because I was probably about 12 then, but John Beattie took me doing aerobatics in his chipmunk, which is so cool. The really funny part is that a Navy recruit pilot had gone up previously and had thrown up all over the cockpit, and they had to clean it up. And I'd come up and I'd literally just eaten a full fried breakfast and went up, did aerobatics, and just loved it.
Yeah.
But yeah, he got an awful lot of ribbing for that. So.
Oh, better you than me. And Tim, where does that leave Fairford? It's the last one, I think, to declare, isn't it?
Well, I mean, Cosford also has been cancelled. So Fairford, Flying Legends at the at its new venue of Sewell. I mean, what it is doing actually is, you know, there are obviously question marks, but what it is doing is it means that maybe the second half or the last quarter of the year might be. Might be better, you know, might be a really, you know, busy time for delayed air shows and trade exhibitions and stuff. So November, you've got the Dubai air show, you've got possibly a delayed Avalon air show in Australia. So that's 100 years of the Royal Australian Air Force, so they're keen to kind of hold it, so that might be happening in the latter part of the year. And Zhuhai in China. So Zhuhai was, you know, China's big air show, and that's now, they're now talking about that, doing that before November. So assuming some sort of travel restrictions ease, yeah, get your passports ready for the tail end of this year.
And any plans for the society to send someone out to the Chinese show at all?
I think it all depends on COVID restrictions so far, yeah. and whether it can be confirmed.
Yeah, rather you than me, I think, at the moment. Anyway, listen, to wrap up, one final story that caught my eye, Tim. Airbus intends ETOPS operations for the Beluga XL to support transatlantic operations. I was trying to get my head around that, cool as it is, for that to happen. Is that a strategic change for Airbus in its manufacturing strategy?
I don't think so. But remember, there is a sort of a small but niche market for oversized transport. So in the past, sort of, you know, the Belugas have transported, you know, giant things like works of art, you know, big kind of bulky but light kind of sort of objects. And interestingly, what I mean, there's a space connection here, is OneWeb, Airbus's OneWeb factory is in Florida.
Okay.
So if you were wanted to transport a lot of satellites, you know, a few OneWeb satellites from Florida to maybe Cornwall or the UK, you know, possibly that's one way of getting them across in short notice, not putting them on a barge or something. So yeah. You know, it might be it gives them more flexibility, put it that way.
Yeah, okay. Sarah, that just reminded me about the news we saw this week about rocket launches from Scotland. How exciting is it that we're in the space race?
Well, I think we've always been in the space race, but I think the difference with, you know, the UK compared to other countries is we're not very good at shouting about it. So I think when so many people think of space exploration, they think of NASA or they think of the European Space Agency, perhaps, and the Russians. But with the UK, although, of course, we have Tim Peake and Helen Sharman and some astronauts who become, you know, British born but became Americans to go to space, although we don't really lead the way in terms of sending people to space, when it comes to small satellites, we've had huge successes for decades now, for many years. And I think, although it might not be as sexy as seeing humans going into space, a lot of what we do in space is to benefit life on Earth. And there's a huge space industry within the UK. There's a lot of great talent here. And I think it's just great that we're seeing the recognition, you know, within the media and outside of the industry for what the UK is doing. So, yes, it's exciting. It's the next step forward, you know, potential for seeing. It's important to caveat that. So we're not actually going to see rockets launching from Cornwall, for example, but we'll see you know, air launch, which is you know, it's a more economical way of doing it, and it's particularly beneficial for smaller satellites. So it's exciting that we're part of the space race, and we have been part of the space race for a long time, although I don't like to use that term, the space race, anymore. I feel like we're in this entrepreneurial space age, and what we're actually seeing is almost like a new Wild West in terms of many countries now and many individuals as well are kind of like eyeing at that piece of the pie, because there's a lot of money to be made from space exploration. A lot of money is going to be lost, but there's also a lot of money to be made as well as bringing a lot of benefit here on Earth.
Yeah. And Sarah, just one quick question before we go to a break. What's the intelligence in the space network, in your space network, about Tim Peake potentially returning to space? Is there any chatter about that potentially happening?
I feel like you'll have to ask Tim Peake himself. I think that's something to ask Tim Peake.
All right. Well, Tim, you did get him on the show before. There you go. There's your challenge. We need to get him back.
Ask him that question.
His book is the next book to read after Sarah's on my pile. So
read them at the same time.
Right, we're going to take a quick break and then we're going to come back and talk about Look Up.
From across the globe, from the center of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Okay, so we've got as a special guest, obviously, for this episode, Sarah Kridas, who space journalist extraordinaire and author of Look Up, which is her latest book that came out last year. I mean, just quickly, it's a great book for me as it kind of summarizes some of the arguments or some of the kind of things that go in my head, and that I want to sort of kind of tell non-space geek friends about as to why space matters. You know, it's not because I'm lazy, but that it's because they're all in there in your book, Sarah. And I think it's also a great antidote to kind of all this relentless doom and gloom that, over the past sort of year and kind of rekindles a sense of wonder. So firstly, just to start off, I mean, you've got you're a space journalist. You've previously before COVID, you've been visiting some amazing places and seen amazing things. What sparked off your personal interest in space and spaceflight in the first place?
I think that's a great question. For me, I've never known a time when space hasn't been my passion, to be honest with you. I think one of my first memories is of looking up at the moon at the, in the night sky as a kid. And I think lots of kids look up at the moon and they're fascinated by it. And I was literally hooked from then on. You know, my answer would always be, why would you not care about space? You know, it's as much about philosophy and religion and the search for meaning as it is about science. You know, that we're this one tiny, tiny planet, which is one part of an average solar system, which is one of many billions, trillions, which exist in a universe which is so large we cannot even begin to comprehend. And why would you not care about that? Why would you, why would you spend all your life on Earth looking down when you could look up and see, look out of our spaceship window, so to speak, and see what it is that we're a part of? So for me, it's genuinely a lifelong fascination. I knew no one who was interested in space, but it was literally my first memory. Then I remember learning about space exploration in primary school and learning about Venus and being hooked on the fact there was this world out there which is so alien from our own, like Earth's evil twin, so to speak, with its, choking thick atmosphere. And I just love space exploration, and like many people, I've got sidetracked. I'm not going to pretend my life's perfect like anyone else's, but that love of space always stayed with me, and I was lucky enough to be able to turn it into a career. And it's just, I think, and I like what you mentioned as well about hope, and I wrote this book. So this time last year, so pre-lockdown, I went into a self-imposed lockdown, little did I know, to actually finish writing the book, because I tried to write it on aeroplanes and it just didn't work, because I like to spend most of my time looking out the window because it's the closest I will get to space. So I put myself into lockdown before lockdown was even really a thing. And then when I was writing the book, all COVID was happening. And I feel like human ingenuity and science and innovation, they're positive stories and they give us hope. And I think what we've seen with all the science and innovation, which has gone behind the jabs, the vaccines for COVID, is another great story of humans coming together and working together. So my thinking with this book in such a dark time, and I have to shout out to my publishers who pretty much said, you can write whatever you want. So I just did a brain dump of all the things I wanted to write about. But my kind of thing was, in such a dark time, space exploration, the stories of the people behind it, space exploration, and the possibility and the wonder can give us hope. It doesn't matter whether you're 6 or 66, there's still hope and wonder and meaning to come from space and to know more about why we explore space, how it benefits our life, and what could potentially be out there.
So what kind of inspired you to write it in the first place? I mean, if you just answer that, or and how long did it take to write? Did it just come quickly, or
was it kind of difficult? I hate writing, Tim. I don't know whether you'll put that in your outtakes. So this is my first adult's book. I've done three kids' books previously. I wrote my first kids' book because an agent at the time, an old agent now, told me I wouldn't be able to write a book. So I immediately went out and wrote one. And then I did another one. And then I did a third one. And then I had an opportunity to pitch an adult's book. By this time, I had a literary agent, Lauren, who's fantastic, who pitched ideas with me. So it wasn't really like I'd ever had this burning desire to write an adult's book, but the opportunity kind of came up. But it's a difficult process. I mean, I was filming a Discovery TV show in Mexico, literally hiding from the cartel, when I decided to write this book. And I was kind of like, oh, future Sarah will deal with that problem. And it's a hard slog writing a book. I have so much respect for anyone who's done it, because it's not easy. But my kind of hope with it and more so now than ever because of the environment we live in at the moment, is that this book can provide people with hope and wonder and curiosity. And I like to think it's relatively easy to read. So that is kind of my thinking behind the book. I never set out to become an author, but I am passionate about telling stories, and it's hard, but I'm proud to have done it. And I have to shout out to Michael Collins as well, Apollo 11 astronaut Michael Collins, who so kindly, I was absolutely blown away, wrote the foreword for Look Up, and that's just a huge honor. I mean, Charles Lindbergh wrote the foreword for Michael Collins' book, and now he's wrote the foreword for mine, so I feel like I'm a very disappointing chain in that lineage.
Well, so you preempted my next question about the rather famous person to writing an introduction for that. I mean, how on earth did that get? Does that come about in the first place? You go to an Apollo astronaut and say, I've written a book about space. Do you want to take a look?
Yeah, pretty much. you don't ask, you don't get. I've been lucky enough to work with a lot of astronauts just because of the line of work that I do, at least pre-COVID, when it was events and stuff like that. I'd met Michael in 2019 when I was, I think, still trying to delude myself that you could write books whilst on flights. I reached out to his people and I asked, and they liked what they saw, and he very kindly agreed to do the forward. And it's everything we do in space exploration is only possible because of those who took the first footsteps. And I mean, 1,000 years from now, no offense, but no one's going to remember any of us. But people will remember Neil, Buzz and Michael. They remember the crew of the Apollo 11. So it was such a huge honor to have him. And I think in a world full of celebrities and Kardashians and influencers and whatever, we need to realize who the real heroes are in terms of progressing humanity and achieving great things, and people who will really be there 1,000 years from now, or 10,000 years from now. And it's just such a huge honor to have his words in my book. And to, he talks about this phrase, outward bound, and how humans need to continue outward bound. And I hope by continuing to tell his story that we can continue to inspire people about what they did, the sacrifice of the first astronauts, the first space explorers, and why we need to continue in their name.
Yeah, on that theme, I mean, Apollo was a defining moment in human history. I mean, there's still a staggering number of people who don't believe that we went to the moon. I mean, that's perhaps something we should have paid more attention to before the era of fake news. So apart from the Buzz Aldrin approach punching out people who say that we didn't land on the moon, what do you think is the best way to convince skeptics to say that, you know, we went to the moon?
I think the best expression is, like, you can't... Can I swear on this podcast? You have a swearing? Can I... can you please out swear words if I do? I just think you shouldn't entertain the argument. There's no point. We shouldn't even be discussing it now. I mean, I've turned down national TV appearances in the UK where they've wanted to debate whether we've landed on the moon or not. And it's this kind of false equivalency that we're seeing within the media of having one person with an unfounded belief versus science fact or historical fact. And, you know, at the almost... I wouldn't say comical, but, you know, the less extreme thing, you've got Apollo, but then it gets much, much darker. And I just think there's no point even having the conversation. We need to move on from that.
All right, fair enough. So
I didn't mean you personally. I meant just as a society. We need to move on.
My argument would be it's the Cold War. The Soviet Union would be looking at for any evidence to trip NASA and the US up.
The problem is you can't argue with stupid, Tim.
So you mentioned this in your book a little bit, but curious to hear you talk about it again. So to play devil's advocate, you know, why not fix the problems on Earth before setting out for other planets? So it's kind of, you know, why are we going off to kind of ruin Mars with robots, industry, et cetera, why not fix everything on Earth first?
Because that's never going to happen. If people had said that 1,000 years ago, why not fix everything in Europe before going out exploring? We wouldn't have the world of today. Humans are built to go over the hill. Humans are built to explore. And if you look historically, the poorest now has more than most did 100 years ago. So what we need to do, and I actually am going to quote Michael Collins again, is so in his speech, 1969, addressing Congress in the US, he talked about how on the way to the moon, the Apollo spacecraft was rotating. He likened it to a chicken on a barbecue spit. And they had a choice of what to look at out of the window. They could either look back at the Earth and see where they came from, or they could look forward towards the moon. And Michael explained how they looked both ways. They looked back at the Earth and they looked forwards towards the moon. And then he went on to explain, and that is what we need to do. So when they went to the moon in 1969, there were still problems raging on Earth, but going to the moon changed us. It changed everything. We're no longer a species confined to one world. So we need to do both. We need to look after Earth, but we need to continue outward bound, continue exploring, and continue to do what it is that makes us innately human. And we've also got to remember that much of what we do in space actually benefits life here on Earth. And I talk about this a lot in the book, but everything from connectivity, bridging the digital divide so that, people in developing countries have access to the internet. And with that comes business opportunities and education and medical opportunities, to helping everything from farming to developing communities, to terrorism, to security, to poaching, you name it, space and satellites in space looking back at Earth can improve life on Earth. And it increases technology, expands the rate of technology and innovation, inspiration as well. As we get more astronauts going into space from different communities, different countries, how's that going to inspire different communities here on Earth? And then at the same time, we need to continue outward bound, but we need to include everyone, because when we go to space, we don't do as one niche group. And I think we've been guilty of doing that in the past, but we go to space for all of humanity and for citizens of planet Earth. And I think as we continue outward bound, we need to involve as many people as possible, both by explaining how space exploration and going to space and space technology benefits life on Earth, but also continuing to push the boundaries and have people from all kinds of backgrounds in space.
That was a really interesting point, actually, and that sort of leads on to my next question. You mentioned.
Did I see your questions, Tim?
You want questions beforehand? Mentioned in the book about the great explorers, the age of exploration, and the idea of you're setting off on a long sort of kind of sea voyage, and you don't know exactly what's going to happen. A trip to Mars might be something like that, where chances of survival, slim.
Would you go to Mars?
But there's a backlash now against using words like colonization to describe humans living on Mars. Some people worry that the Earth power structures will be transferred to human settlements on Moon Mars. I mean, should we worry about that when it's so far off? And can you actually colonize something that where there's no life to displace or not or oppress?
I think it's a great question. In terms of should we worry about it, I don't think you should lose any sleep about it. There's other more pressing things at the moment. However, it does raise interesting questions in terms of who owns space. A similar example would be with Arctic exploration, but I think what we're seeing in space exploration is more exciting. So at the moment, it's kind of almost like maritime law in terms of who can claim and the uses of space. But what we're going to see actually developing at the same time is space law and regulation, but there's no point putting that regulation in place before we've done anything. But in parallel to humans going out into space and humans exploring, we're going to see this law developing. And you've got to remember, there's a lot of, not just national interest, but also private industry. There's money to be made in space exploration. So yes, there is going to be things developing, laws. There's a potential for a lot to go wrong, but there's also a potential for a lot to go right. And we've got to remember, going to space is incredibly hard, and it's beyond any one person, any one company, any one nation. We need international collaboration. And my hope is, as we've seen with much of space exploration, there will be international collaboration going forward, because when we go to space, we all call the same planet home.
Okay. Well, what about, and I think I probably know the answer to this one, robotic versus human exploration? Some people would argue robots cheaper, you could get for the price of one human, making a human survive in the vacuum, you can get much more bang for buck by lots of space probes.
I think that's a great argument. Personally, I think we should do them all. And it almost frustrates me. Like, for example, you've got Europa, this icy moon of Jupiter, frozen icy surface, highly probable there's a liquid ocean underneath. Europa's a great candidate for life elsewhere in our solar system, but we haven't really started exploring yet. And it's we've got all these ideas and places we want to go, but the budgets are never there, and that's frustrating. If I had my way, we'd send much more spacecraft out, we'd fund science and space exploration a lot more. But in terms of robots versus humans, we need both. Robots can take risks that humans can't. If you lose a robot, yes, it's expensive, but it's not a human life. They can go further. They don't need food or water or to go to the toilet or stuff like that. They're less complicated in that sense, but nothing really is going to replace human eyes, human dexterity. The fact that a human can look around and see something that a robot might not be able to spot, even with a camera being operated from Earth. So we need both. Great science, and there's a lot of people who would argue just for robotic missions, and I can understand that. Great science comes from that, but you can't beat the inspiration. Imagine, hopefully this decade, seeing human beings back on the surface of the moon, for example, and imagine how you'll feel looking up at the moon and knowing that there's a person there looking back at you. You can't, the people who were inspired by Apollo built the modern world we live in today, and you can't imagine what inspiration and what change is going to come from a generation that sees humans living on another planet, living on the moon or living on Mars. You can't measure it, but you can't ever underestimate that value of human space exploration. And at the end of the day, the ultimate goal is for humans to go beyond Earth and to see what is out there. So you're always going to need human exploration.
And thinking about moon exploration, predictions for President Biden and the future of Armistice, Apollo. I mean, here's the point: Apollo waned after the U.S. had won the space race, and then the politicians lost interest. And how do you maintain that momentum of public interest if at least in space programs, at least in Western democracies, are dominated by the electoral cycle, and that every 4 years or whenever somebody new gets in and goes, this doesn't fit our agenda?
You ask the tough questions, but I think you make some very fair points there. And I think, look at Mars, for example, or many presidents have thought about sending human beings to Mars, but we've never actually seen that happen. That's because you'd need more than 8 years to get human beings to Mars, so it'd be beyond their kind of like presidential terms, assuming they serve both terms. In terms of Biden and Artemis. It's interesting, he hasn't spoken that much on it yet, so it's kind of like a wait and see. At the moment, everything's going ahead, but who knows? We can't, you know, we can't predict the future. I know it's a bit of a cop-out to say, but my money would also be on watching for private industry and space exploration. And I think with Artemis as well, you've got a lot of private collaboration with companies such as Blue Origin, you know, the potential for SpaceX to be involved with that as well. So, you know, or SpaceX are involved with that. So, you know, hopefully it will happen. I'm optimistic it will happen. But I think what we're going to see is a shift towards more public-private partnerships, which will mean things happen faster in a way that, that governments might not allow.
So what one person that is going or is hoping to go Mars, you know, full steam ahead, damn the torpedoes, Mars or bust, Elon Musk.
Genius
messiah or crazed capitalist baron?
Does it matter if he's a crazed capitalist baron? I mean, you know, throughout history, it's been the mavericks, those who have gone against the status quo, who have enabled us to do things which have changed the world, changed society, and shaped the world we live in today. So, yes, his ideas sound bold and ridiculous. And, you know, so what if he fails? Failure is just, you know, a step on the path to success. So it's interesting times. My money is also on Jeff Bezos. I mean, what he's doing with Blue Origin has been incredibly exciting. They've been working in stealth mode for so long now. So I think, you know, you've got a lot of billionaires who've got their eyes on space exploration. You've got a lot of individuals. You've got a lot of people who want to push the boundaries. But in terms of Elon Musk, yes, he might be a lot of things, but he's also trying to push the frontier of humanity into space. And I think anything which gets us talking about space exploration is a good thing.
All known paths of the history of flying. It's created by experienced, award-winning former Aeroplane magazine editors Mick Ogee, that's me, and Nick Stroud, so you can trust it for quality, accuracy, and sheer passion for the subject. The Aviation Historian. We're print, we're digital, but we're not in the shops. Order us online and find out more at theaviationhistorian.com. Are you ready for it?
So, I mean, you know, on a similar note, we've got celebrity astronauts. I mean, Tom Cruise is going to go, apparently, go to the ISS.
Potentially, yeah.
Potentially. We've got the first private mission now, Inspiration 4. So these are all good things.
Yeah, I think they're all good things. And I think we need to be okay if these things fail. Because, you know, as I said, failure is on a pathway to success. And I think particularly here in the UK or in Europe, we don't embrace failure in the same way that they do in the US. So if something goes wrong, it doesn't matter. The, you know, space exploration's hugely difficult, and we've got all these companies bubbling up at the moment, and many of them are going to fail. Many of them won't succeed. Many of them will find alternative routes to try and do what they're trying to achieve. But all of them are trying to do something extraordinary.
And that's also another interesting thing, isn't it? I mean, about the sort of startup culture of space at the moment, of, you know, kind of two, three people together and kind of, you know, they have a bright idea. And it's and one of the things also in Look Up that you noted was, you know, kind of companies, you know, where does a space company begin and where does it end? So, you know, is Uber a space company because it uses satellites to get your cab? Or
I'm glad you read my book because I mentioned that example.
Well, you know, or Domino's to track your pizza. You know, that's using space. And it's so sort of ubiquitous now. We don't even give it a second thought, do we?
Well, that's the thing. We're living in a space age without realizing it. And the joke I like to say is we jumped into cyberspace instead of outer space. So you're absolutely correct. I, like many others, have been guilty of having one too many Domino's during this very long UK lockdown. But you track your pizza, you track how far it is away from your house. And that, you know, that's using GPS, which is relying on satellites in space. So the modern comforts, you know, which make our lives a little more convenient, perhaps a little lazier as well, are owed to the space age. And there is kind of this blurring of the line of whether you'd, for example, let's use Uber, call that a space company or a tech company, because obviously it's using an app, it's using technology with your smartphone, But then it relies on satellites in space for GPS to actually tell you where you're going, tell you where your location is and stuff like that. So there is this blurring of the line. And that's the thing, the space future we're living in right now looks nothing like what was imagined in the 1960s. It's something we couldn't imagine. That was beyond the imagination. And I think that's what's so exciting about what's happening now in space exploration, because we can try and make predictions about 10 years' time, 20 years' time, 50 years' time. But the reality is we do not know what's going to happen. It will always be something we have failed to imagine. And it's just so exciting to think about how that will transform the world and how the next generation will take that for granted.
But more satellites, more mega constellations. I mean, you know, I think there was some stat that said 30% of the satellites now in orbit have been launched over the past year. And that's looking at SpaceX Starlink.
That's a great start. I'm going to use that. Thanks, Tim.
But, you know, more cluttered orbit, more chance of space debris. I mean, how big a danger is this, and what's the risk of us kind of using up this kind of common good and you know, kind of darkening the skies?
I think I'm glad you raised this, because sometimes I think certain people within the industry kind of forget about debris, and it's a huge issue. I mean, and the thing is with space debris, if one piece of space junk hits another piece of space junk, you know, that then creates a lot more space junk, and then you have even more space junk in orbit, and then it becomes like an increasing problem. So already the International Space Station has had to adjust its orbit ever so slightly because of pieces of space debris. It poses a threat to astronauts in orbit. It poses a threat to satellites, which again benefit life on Earth. So there is a huge issue. And I think when we first went to space exploration, we didn't really think about it because it was a war. And also humans just kind of tend to throw out the trash and not think about it. But now things are changing. So there's certainly quite a few companies around which are looking at actually ways to get rid of existing space debris, either placing it in like a graveyard orbit or getting it to burn up back in Earth. And new satellites as well either have enough fuel on them so that they can, when they've served their period in space and their use, actually either change their orbit and burn back up in the Earth's atmosphere, or again go in this graveyard orbit. So there are changes in place for modern satellites, but there is still a lot of debris up there, and there's going to be a lot of money that can be made from a company which can actually work out how to get rid of all that junk in space, all that debris, because it represents a huge problem, and if we're not careful, we'll end up trapping ourselves once again on this planet.
Space salvage.
There's always money in rubbish, isn't there?
Ellie, I think you've got a question.
I do. I've got to say, I haven't read Look Up yet, but listening to that, I really, really need to. It sounds so good.
Thank you.
But I have a couple of questions, kind of unrelated, but I quite often get told that I don't look like a pilot. And in fact, I've actually had someone stop me from getting back to my aircraft because the area was for pilots only. But that being said, have you ever been in a situation where you've been denied access to something because you don't look like a scientist?
Yeah, I've never been denied access. And it's funny that I was in a Vogue article back in September, and the title of the piece was like, I get told I don't look like a scientist. And it was on just this subject. I remember once it was... I think it was 2015, 2016, something like that, the winter of 2015 or 16, the years kind of blur. And I was on the way to host the IET Young Woman Engineer of the Year Awards. And I was in a taxi traveling from mine to the event, and the taxi driver got chatting, and he was like, "What do you do?" And I explained, I just simplified it and said, I work in space and astrophysics. And he replied, "Isn't that for boys? You don't look like a scientist." And that's probably the worst I've ever had. And that was great because it gave me my opening speech for this Women in Engineering event. So I think it does exist, but I think it's changing. And to be honest with you, I've been lucky. It's never really held me back. I haven't faced discrimination. Like, your story sounds horrific by being told you don't look like a pilot when you are a pilot. I think I've been lucky in many ways, but I think, yeah, there is this kind of stereotype. I've been told actually by a broadcaster once that, you know, I don't know whether I should tell this story, but sod it, I will. But that I didn't look like a scientist and I needed to wear less makeup if I was going to do this TV report about space. And it's just, you know, that's so sexist, but I think attitudes are changing now. And I think, you know, the Aeronautical Society is doing great work. Organisations are doing great work to be more inclusive. So it is changing, but it's slow to the change, I guess, and it's frustrating. But that, you know, you've got to keep fighting the fight, I guess.
That is so interesting. That's really, really awesome. Thank you so much.
And thank you for all you're doing. I wish I could fly. I'm so impressed. Like, many people wish I couldn't fly. Pardon?
You need to come for a flight with me.
I would love that. I'm going to hold you to that.
One of the reasons that we want to work more with Ellie in particular, Sarah, is you're really a role model for a lot of young people, but particularly young girls. And we're really keen to encourage youngsters, but, you know, particularly girls as well. You know, I've got a 10-year-old daughter and we watched the launch of Perseverance, and she's now realised that it's coming to land and she's got that interest. So how do you think we can capture that imagination with so many distractions in the world today for youngsters?
I think that's a tough question. And I would kind of flip it on the head and say, don't force anyone to do anything they don't love. Encourage people to follow their passions, because if you're passionate about something, you will eventually succeed. You might fail a lot on the way, but you will eventually get there. So my advice would just be encouraging people to follow their passions. And my hope is that one day, instead of talking about the first woman to set foot on the moon, for example, or the first woman to do this, we'll see women smashing records for humanity instead of just for women. So my advice would be just to not put limits on people, to not tell people they can't do something, but just to encourage them to follow their passions and not to make it about gender, just make it about passion and inspiration.
Well, that's fantastic. Thanks, Sarah.
On sort of a similar note, I mean, Sarah, do you think there's been a shift in how cool space is seen by the wider public and media in the past 15, 20 years? You know, films, Ad Astra, Interstellar, Gravity, adverts, branding, popular culture, you know, products, people sending you know, stuff to near space in balloons. Is it real, or is it just the space geeks are now on social media, so it seems like there's more of it?
So basically everyone you follow talks about this.
Hang on a sec.
Launch Twitter is brilliant.
Go to space.
No, the space race. So that was my kid's book. That went to space. That went using a high altitude weather balloon. Yeah. And I launched the space race to space because I wanted to show that space is relatable. It's only, you know, a couple of hundred miles up. 100 miles up, you know, the International Space Station, for example, which seems so far away, is the same distance roughly as London is from Newcastle. Space isn't far away. It's just taken a long time for us to be able to access it. So that's why I sent my book, The Space Race, to space. But I do think space is becoming cool again. I think when I was into space, when I was in school, I mean, I had ginger hair at the time, and there's anything wrong with ginger hair, but my last name's Crudus and I grew up in Hull. So I wasn't the most popular kid with my love of space. And I was also a member of Airbus Club, which I thought was amazing, but again, probably wasn't that cool in school. you would have loved Airbus Club. It was great. But we, you know, space wasn't that cool. But it's even on a more superficial level. You see H&M, for example, other shops are available selling NASA, you know, T-shirts, for example. And space is kind of cool and exciting. And it's something which is more ever present. And I think we're, you know, I wasn't around for Apollo, but I think what we're starting to see is that appetite, that hunger, that excitement for we are doing something new that hasn't been seen since Apollo. And I do think, even though the last year was a terrible one and still isn't great for so many, because we've been certainly in the UK locked in our homes, that's given a lot of people the opportunity to look up, you know, take up new hobbies. You don't need a telescope. You literally just need a window and look out of it and look up at the night sky, or to watch launches live and to learn more about space exploration. So I think it is becoming cooler, more stuff's going on, and more people are realizing this is the future and they want to be part of it.
I mean, again, to play devil's advocate here, I mean, do we think we romanticise space a bit too much? I mean, are the kind of the space geek community, the enthusiasts, are we guilty of putting rose-tinted spectacles on? Not being a bit more dispassionate about it. I mean, my take on that is that if you're talking about human space flight, it's still incredibly dangerous. And I think, was it John Young who said something like, if anyone who climbs onto a rocket stack and isn't fearful hasn't understood the problem or something like that, you know. So people putting their lives on the line for exploration, for science, you know, it still goes back to kind of Tom Wolfe's The Right Stuff, doesn't it?
It doesn't. It goes back to the early age of aviation as well. Those who went first, lives were lost. And I think we do romanticize that because it is dangerous. But you've got to remember, fewer than 600 human beings have gone to space. All those who've been to space have been aware of the risks. You know, all of them have lost colleagues and friends in accidents in space exploration. You know, we've got to remember, two shuttles were lost. Apollo 1 was lost. There was tragedies in Russia as well. Yuri Gagarin, died a few years after he became the first man into space in an air crash, incidentally. But space and training for space exploration is risky business. So, yes, we're probably guilty of romanticising it. But those who work at that top level, at the tip of the arrow, so to speak, within the industry, and those who support them, it's a career and it's life or death. But at the same time, this is it. You only get one life, and what they're doing, we're all going to die sometime, I guess. And what they're doing and what they're risking their lives for is pushing the envelope, pushing what is possible, just like those aviators did 100 years ago or so. So yes, perhaps we romanticize it, but so what? Don't we want to, as a species, progress further and see what else is out there?
Okay. Apart from Mars probes turning up in Martian orbit, what else we got to look forward to? Exciting things to happen in 2021 space wise.
Well,
or even next year.
Oh yeah, well, probably lots of things for next year that we haven't even thought of as well. So my top few picks, I would say Crew Dragon is going to be launching again. So we're going to see four astronauts launching to space. It's looking like it's going to be around April at the moment. So that's, another SpaceX launch sending astronauts to the International Space Station. Interestingly, the first female astronaut going on Crew Dragon is the wife of Bob Behnken. So it's interesting how you've had this husband who was, of course, on the first Crew Dragon mission. So you've now had this husband and wife team going on Crew Dragon. Also, Starliner, so the Boeing Starliner test flight, that'd be successful. Potentially, Starliner will be sending crew to space this year. Of course, the current SpaceX Dragon capsule, which is in space, will return to Earth. So that'll be once again testing out the astronaut splash it, that space capsule splashing down in the ocean. We've then also got, I'm just cherry picking as well, we've got the James Webb Space Telescope, which is hopefully launching. It's been launching for a few years now, but you've got to remember, we're trying to do something which has never been done before. This space telescope is going to be put into what is known as Lagrange 2. So that's an orbit. It's beyond the moon. It's not in a place where you can actually fix it, like we could have fixed the Hubble Space Telescope, like we did fix the Hubble Space Telescope when something went wrong. So it's a complicated mission. It's going to photograph the earliest galaxies and help us again get another piece of that jigsaw puzzle to understand more about the universe, where we come from, why we exist, etc. So that is going to be a huge mission for astronomy. Hopefully that will be launching in the autumn. Fingers crossed for that. I know a lot of people are kind of complacent that this might get moved, but even if it does and say it's 2022, that will still be a huge moment for space exploration and for astronomy.
Wow. And so thinking of sort of space telescopes peering into the furthest reaches of the galaxy and things like that and looking at what's your personal take on intelligent life in the universe? I mean, what's the Sarah Crudas sort of answer to the Fermi paradox? So are we in a cosmic zoo? Is it dark forest theory? Are aliens out there?
Well, I wish I had the answer. We all do, don't we? I think we'd be naive to think that we are alone in the universe. Certainly, for example, say there's microbial life on Mars and say it's unrelated to life on Earth, because there is all this theory that life on Earth might have been seeded from Mars during the much younger solar system. So say there's, we find conclusive evidence of microbial life on Mars unrelated to life on Earth. So technically we've got some sort of alien, which, you know, highly probable there's microbial life elsewhere within our solar system. Then that becomes, you know, the fact that we've got two genesises within this one average solar system. We know there's trillions, you know, countless solar systems out there. So if you extrapolate that, you know, it's likely that there's a lot of life out there in the universe. Of course, these are all just subjective. We haven't proved anything yet. But then the question really becomes, is there intelligent life out there? And, you know, there's lots of different ways of looking at it. You know, if I had the answer, I think we'd be having a different conversation right now. You know, one of the best comparisons I've ever heard is, if you were walking down the street and saw some ants, would you stop and try and have a chat with those ants? You wouldn't.
I've been in lockdown for quite a while. It's possible.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. So pre-lockdown, if you saw some ants walking down the street, you probably wouldn't try and communicate with the ants. And that's almost the way we need to look at potential, and again, we've got to be quite vague with our language here, of life elsewhere in the universe, because there could be alien life out there. It could have just passed Earth by, because it's like that human walking by the ants. It doesn't even see it as something it can communicate with. So we, you know, we don't know. I wish we knew. We could all be in a computer simulation. We could be some high school kids science project. We just don't know. Any ideas kind of game at the moment, but I'm optimistic that within the next few decades we'll likely be able to have enough evidence to say that we're not alone in the universe, but the likely answer will be microbial life found elsewhere within our solar system, and not little green men or some other type of alien.
So for anyone listening to this podcast on Alpha Centauri, the secret is to bang the rocks together, those guys. So this is probably going to lose 50% of your fan base. Favorite science fiction show and spaceship?
Favorite science fiction show? This is a hard question. You might have to like cut me out. I'm in a hurry. Favorite science fiction show? I think you put me on the spot here so much. I am going to say Westworld.
Ooh.
Which isn't even a space show, but it's robotics. No. And it's science-y. I kind of like dystopian kind of like science fiction. And if I was to say space one, I was going to say Stargate.
Stargate, okay. So yep. Favorite spaceship? Fictional spaceship?
Fictional spaceship. Do you know... I don't know whether I should say this. I'm not a great science fiction buff.
End the interview here, Peter.
When I was doing my undergraduate in astrophysics, and we'd have like physics nights out, and all the like postgrads and the undergrads would go back to watch Star Trek at someone's home after like a night out, and I'd just go home at that point.
Sarah, I'm with you. I'm with you. The only science fiction I've read is I don't know if it is science fiction. Well, The Martian. I just don't like fiction, yeah. Really. The Martian was brilliant. I'm afraid I'm with you, but...
Come on, everyone should be watching The Expanse right now.
I've watched a bit of The Expanse.
Well, I was going to say, Sarah, you've seen real spaceships lift off, haven't you?
I know, I've got to give you an answer on my science fiction one, though.
Go on, then.
I'll say my favourite science fiction one is, what was the one in 2001, A Space Odyssey?
Discovery.
There we go. Wow, that's appalling.
That was a quick response, Tim.
So
that was a real geek's response.
Yeah. So
Tim's going to disown me.
So, well, no, not necessarily. But what's your personal space moment? I mean, you've like I was supposed to say, you know, you've seen real spaceships lift off. You've met Apollo astronauts. So, what's your personal space moment that tops everything else?
Without a doubt, when I was working, my first job was as a weather presenter for the BBC, and it wasn't the love of my life, let's just say, but it was my first job and it was exciting to be doing broadcasting. And I took leave from the BBC to go out to go out for the final space shuttle launch and landing Atlantis. So took holiday from the BBC, went out to America, had no commissions for any work. and managed, luckily they needed a reporter, and because I was there, they used me. And my favorite moment was the landing of Atlantis, the last time a space shuttle has ever landed. And I was broadcasting live on the BBC, sat in literally a swamp by this runway, covered in mosquito bites because I've been working through the night. And I got to witness Atlantis landing on the runway, you know, the final landing ever of a space shuttle. And it changed my life. It was that going out on a limb and going to Florida and telling about these stories to the BBC, which wasn't necessarily my day job, which kind of like sealed the nail for me to go and follow my dreams of space. So that for me will always be a huge moment, and the moment that changed my life, and just such a privilege. And on a personal level, it showed me that you can go out there and chase your dreams and anything is possible. Don't get me wrong, it's not easy, you know, failure happens all the time as well, but like, yeah, just so proud to be a part of that, so proud to chase a dream, and so proud to be covering history and witnessing history.
Fantastic. All right, so this is my probably final question that I've come to the end, and I mean, I still could keep going on with other you know, sort of you know, burning questions, but future plans, another book?
No.
What's on the horizon for you?
maybe another book. I'll have a think about that. I'm having a little rest. I feel like 4 books in 4 years is quite a lot. I definitely will do another book, but I'd like to have a bit of a break from it. So I don't know if I can announce it in my future plans yet. Can I announce that I'm starting a podcast, or is that going to be like, am I allowed to say that on your podcast?
Of course. Of course. Exciting. We run a group that promotes space and aviation podcasts. So as soon as
fantastic.
It's out, we'll put it on our Facebook group.
So my next immediate plan, I can't tell you anything about it just yet. Probably in the next month or so, I'll announce it on my social media. So that's at Sarah Crudis on Twitter and at Sarah Crudis TV on Instagram, because someone stole my name. So yeah, that's my podcast is my next project coming out, and then hopefully I'm optimistic from the summer onwards that I'll be doing a lot more events out in public with people again, and hosting events and space events. But my podcast is my most immediate project, which I can tell you about.
Watch this space.
That was just fantastic, Sarah. Thank you so much. Really yeah, enjoyed that. It was fabulous, a real inspiration.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Dave Homewood here from the Wings Over New Zealand show. New Zealand's a very aviation minded country, and we have a diverse range of stories out there to tell. The Wings Over New Zealand show brings you all sorts of stories, such as interviews with pilots or ground crew, World War II veterans, post-war Air Force personnel, air show stories, historians, authors, warbird restorers, airline stories, recreational flyers and home builders, agricultural aviation such as top dressing, and a lot more. We've got an extensive archive that you can go back to and listen to all of the shows. And there are new shows coming out all the time. The Wings Over New Zealand show, bringing you New Zealand aviation stories since 2011.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
Okay, over to some feedback from episode 110. Of course, we looked, Ellie and I spoke to Bryce Evans, Professor Bryce Evans, about the history of airline food. And we put the task out there to the listeners to tell us what their best airline food was. So a few examples that came back in. Jimmy Ware, he said British Airways First Class. He even names the flight number, BA2155. I'm not that much of a geek, so I'm not quite sure whereabouts that runs to. Robert Farrell said Turkish Airlines Business Class, top class food.
Main man Micah from Maine said, "It's not fair. I'm listening to an aviation podcast. Should not make me hungry. Don't let that stop you, though. Just have a snack ready when you listen to this episode of Aviation Extended." Thank you, Micah. And then I think this is a spoof account for Nigella Lawson, because they talk about the complimentary mini bottles of red wine from British Airways. So I'm not quite sure that's from Nigella herself. DC Claxton said, "Breakfast on the early morning BA super shuttle from Heathrow to Edinburgh and Glasgow." Yep, I remember those very well, those cooked breakfasts, and the afternoon teas as well, scones and cream on British Airways, I seem to remember. And then my favourite was from Thomas Tom, chicken curry on Vietnam Airlines. He said it was just delicious, restaurant quality, and the cabin crew were even kind enough to give me an extra serving. He can taste it now, but he also says he had a shepherd's pie on British Airways from Heathrow to Geneva, which was also lip-smackingly good. So I'm afraid, Sarah, you did put yourself in the spotlight by talking about how many air miles you had. You're going to have to now tell us. You're going to have to now tell us what's the best airline food you've ever had.
Do you know, I'm such a British Airways girl. Up until so pre-COVID, I've been a gold card holder, humble brag there, with BA for a few years. Best food, though, I'm trying to remember the meals. Normally it's a starter if they do like the smoked salmon starter. That was always my favourite. And then the bread rolls with oil. I think I agree with you with the scones and cream as well.
The shuttles were iconic, actually. They were fantastic. We didn't ask you, Tim.
That's a treat. Yes, so the days where you used to travel on aeroplanes. Probably Singapore Airlines, I think.
Yeah, they are highly recommended, aren't they? Lots of people come back with that one. That's great. Okay, over to some promoting aerospace. Tim, have you got anything before I come back to my mention?
It's just to say it's National Apprentice Week this week in the UK. And just a shout out to say, if you're an apprentice, you get free membership with the RAS.
Didn't know that.
What's not to like? Spread the word.
Okay, we'll keep that message going out there.
And yeah, also a shout out as well to Space Humanity, who I work with, which is a non-profit dedicated to democratizing access to space. So basically funding flights to space for anyone from any walk of life in return for them becoming citizen astronaut ambassadors back here on Earth.
I've got a mention for Matt Willis, and most of our listeners will know Matt. He's a naval air historian, but I heard him on another podcast, on a podcast called History Hack, and he was talking about the Allison-engined Mustang. And it's remarkable service. And I found out he's got his latest book out. It's Mustang, The Untold Story. Hardback, 300 pages. The podcast is absolutely fantastic. He talks on. So I'll put some links in the show notes to that. But also the book looks fascinating as well. He's always highly respected in the arena of historical aviation. So his book will be a definite read. So big shout out to Matt there. That's it then. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. We'd also like to thank the extended family of supporters. Mick Oakey at the Aviation Historian, Simon Jakubowski at the Aviation Enthusiasts Book Club, and of course Andy Wright at Aircrew Book Review. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before you use anything you hear. The programme is produced with a Creative Commons licence. Okay, it's about where we can find you online. Ellie, I'll come to you first. Whereabouts can we find you on social media?
So I'm on Twitter at DragonGirl94. I'm on Instagram, which is EllieCarter74. And I'm on Facebook as just Ellie Carter.
And Tim, where can we find you?
Yeah, I'm tweeting bad aviation puns at RASTimR, and you can find the Royal Aeronautical Society at www.aerosociety.com.
And Sarah, you mentioned your social media feeds earlier, but one of the questions we didn't get to ask you is, where can we get hold of a copy of the book? And more importantly, can we get hold of signed copies or messaged copies?
Yeah, I'm glad you ask, actually. So you can get hold of my book at all good bookshops. Obviously, it's not an ideal time for books at the moment. So it's bookshops at the moment. So it's going to be online. So all the usual suspects online. So look up our Story with the Stars and also the Space Race. If you want signed copies, there are, I think, a few. If you go to my website, sarahquiddis.com, and go to the book section, you should still be able to get some signed copies of Look Up Our Story with the Stars. And I'm hoping in the next few weeks to be able to offer personalized signed copies, both of Look Up Our Story with the Stars and of the Space Race. So if you go to sarahquiddis.com and you follow the links on there for books, you can find out details about personalized signed books.
Wonderful, because I'm going to order one for my daughter. So we're going to get a personalized one. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and of course you can find Aviation Extended on Facebook and Twitter. And that's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye all, see you next time.
Goodbye from Ellie Carter.
Goodbye, thank you so much for listening.
And it's a massive thank you to Sarah Craddis, and a goodbye from Sarah.
And thank you so much for having me, and thank you all of you if you've managed to listen this far at all.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
And I missed your What's Your Space pun. I'm sorry.
Although our Twitter feed is down because I made a bit of an error. But moving swiftly.
What did you do?
Moving swiftly on. Oh, Sarah, real school. School child stuff. I thought it'd be really clever to put our anniversary of our first episode as the birth date. Of course, you have to be 13 to have a Twitter account.
So basically, it's like we had an underage aviation podcast that's been grooming aviation enthusiasts across the world.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah,
it's not a good look.
Twitter, they do not ask for you to confirm it. They just literally take your site down in one fell swoop. So we're just trying to recover that.
6 months old. Like.
Yeah, that's right. I had to send him a copy of my driving license. So fingers crossed, hey?
Extend it.
This is XTP Media.